This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, bricks in the wall. We're not talking Pink Floyd. We're talking how a U.S. police state is being built.
I had the chance of speaking at the Brecht Forum with Vince Warren, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. I talked about what's happening, and Vince talked about how we're fighting back.
Who makes money from mass incarceration? Today, we'll talk with Paul Wright on his new book, Prison Profiteers.
Prison industrial complex is huge. People are making billions on it, billions that should be going to education.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We go now to hear speeches from Bricks in the Wall, How a U.S. Police State is Being Built, a recent event held at the Brecht Forum in New York. We'll bring you speeches from our own Michael Smith, as well as from Vince Warren from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Vince talks about the center's legal response to the police state. Let's have a listen.
I wanted to start off, I suppose, reminding you, because I'm sure you've all heard this from liberals, who wring their hands and they tell you, oh, it's terrible, Abu Ghraib, and the war in Iraq and torture, but don't worry, 12 months from now, the pendulum is going to swing back. Hogwash. The pendulum's not going to swing back. This pendulum is only going to swing back if there are fierce and terrible social struggles to win back what's been taken away. We interviewed Daniel Ellsberg 2 weeks ago on our radio show, Law and Disorder, and Ellsberg said, you know, it dawned on me one morning when I was focusing my thoughts that the coup has already taken place in this country. And all that's needed for them to take their fist out of the glove is some kind of precipitating event, like a war in Iran, another natural disaster, say Atlanta runs out of water, or another terrorist attack, because they've undermined the juridical underpinnings of what we used to know as democracy, or what we Marxists called bourgeois democracy. It was something that we gained in 1789 with the Constitution. Remember, the Constitution wasn't passed because there was such pressure from below, from the small farmers, from people with rifles, from workers. They said, we're not going to pass the Constitution unless we have a Bill of Rights. And the big states like New York and Virginia and Massachusetts supported the Bill of Rights. So we got the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. Those amendments were under a lot of pressure before 9/11. Now, forget it. First, the Fourth, the Fifth, the Sixth, the right to assemble as well as speak, the right to privacy, the right to due process, the right to an attorney, as Lynn mentioned, the right to not be treated cruelly. Those are by the boards. So the liberals are wrong when they tell you that when Hillary gets into office, things are going to get better. Can you imagine, anybody here can imagine that she's going to give up the rights that she has now under NSA spying? It's never happened. When these people in power get it, they don't give it up. What did Frederick Douglass say? Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. So what's happened is that what we used to enjoy as a certain, albeit limited, constricted democracy no longer exists in this country. We used to have checks and balances. Remember, the genius of the constitutional framers was to have three separate branches of government. Congress passes the laws, the executive executes the laws, and the judiciary decides disputes on those laws. That doesn't exist anymore. We have what's called a unitary executive. You have the executive, who's also the commander-in-chief, running things like a general. If a law is passed by Congress that Bush doesn't like, he issues a signing statement saying, I don't like it. I'm only going to enforce part of it. Or I'm not going to enforce it. Doesn't veto it. He just issues a signing statement. He's issued more signing statements than any of all the other presidents before him combined. Well, how did this undermining of our juridical order take place? It started with the authorization for the use of military force. And that grants special powers to the executive branch. And I'll quote you precisely what it does. Quote, that the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons. So you got the president declaring war on people. That's a new concept in Western law. And not just aliens, but American citizens. Persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. That's when it first started, with the authorization for the use of military force. 2 months later, we just had last week the 6th anniversary of military order number one. And that sewed it up. I'm going to read you what Michael Ratner, the president of the Center of Constitutional Rights, wrote last week on the 6th anniversary of the promulgation by Bush of military order number one. I remember thinking to myself, there's just been a coup d'etat in America. Perhaps an exaggeration, but nonetheless a watershed moment in a country that I still thought had some semblance of a democracy and of the principle that the presidential authority was under law. As most of you may not recall, the order, let me remind you, of all its three key provisions. First, the president claimed the authority to capture, kidnap, or otherwise arrest any non-citizen. It was later extended to citizens. Anywhere in the world, including the United States, whom the president believed was involved in international terrorism, and hold them forever without any charges, proceedings, or trial. Amazing. A person could just be held forever just because the president wanted them to be held. He took on the power to disappear people. Second, the order did provide that if, and if is the crucial word here, if the person was tried, there was never needed to be a trial at all, but if he was tried, such trials were to be held by special ad hoc courts called military commissions. These commissions had no resemblance to regular trial courts. The entire proceeding could take place in secret with evidence from torture, and those found guilty could be executed in secret. Third, to the extent the names of those imprisoned or tried could be determined and lawyers found, no court could hear any case, habeas corpus. This order embodies within it the violations of fundamental human rights we are facing today. Indefinite detention without trial, Guantanamo, secret trials, special trials, disappearance sites. While it does not mention torture, that appears to have come a bit later. A secret detention system is part and parcel of a torture system. Let's also repeat, this was a military order in a society and country that was still, or purported to be, under civilian rule. This order, more than any other single document, embodies our lost liberties. It was this document that pushed the Center for Constitutional Rights into action. Well, Clark has called what happened a rolling coup. And I was surprised. I heard Bruce Fein speak a few nights ago. He was the one of the attorneys for Reagan, and the Reagan administration is conservative. And he called it a rolling coup, too. He's come over to our side. Well, I shouldn't say that. The politics have shifted so far to the right that we find ourselves advocating the same sort of thing. The American Bar Association is on our side. American Bar Association. We were on a picket line to protest the arrest of all the Pakistani lawyers with the ABA. Well, what are some of the elements of this rolling coup? Clark obliged me and made a list. Initial seizure of the presidency by stopping the vote count in Florida. Doctrine of global superiority and advocacy of preemptive war, like Iraq or Iran. Did you know that Congress has voted to give Bush the authority to go to war against Iran whenever he wants? Republicans and Democrats alike, did you know that? Repudiation of treaties such as the ABM Treaty. Refusal to recognize international law or applicability of the Geneva Accords. Roundup of immigrants after 9/11. People held without charges. September 13th grant of open-ended military authority to the president. Domestic deployment of military as law enforcement. They got a bill through Congress violating the venerable 1878 Posse Comitatus Act that said you couldn't use the military for domestic law enforcement. Now Bush can get the National Guard from State A and use them in State C without the permission of either of the governors of A or C. Establishment of military tribunals in Guantanamo, secret deportation hearings, seizure of citizens as enemy combatants, effective end of habeas corpus, massive secret wiretaps in violation of the FISA law. That court was asked to give warrants 10,000 times, and they only turned them down four times. They don't like that law. Issuance of secret administrative warrants for all kinds of records, suppression of Muslim charities, secret sneak and peek searches, classification of most government records. And that's a reversal of the idea that we won after the upheavals of the 60s. We had FOIA, you know, you could ask for something, they'd give it to you. Ratner got the CIA dossier in Che Guevara, which we published. You can't get any of that stuff anymore. Ashcroft said, don't give them a thing, and if they want it, make them litigate and we'll defend you. You can't get any of it. It's secret government. Special rendition, that's when they outsource torture. Establishment of a privatized military, you know, like Blackwater. Assertion of executive supremacy through signing statements. Expanded use of recess appointments. Doctrine of the unitary executive. And to cap it off, they got a subsidiary of Halliburton called Kellogg Brown and Root. Gave them $385 million, and they built a huge detention camp. And they said it's not just for illegal immigrants. So just let me say in conclusion, significant changes in the law are the product of class struggles over the institutions that determine social change. Feudal law was eventually replaced by capitalist law. You know, we now have the right to contract, to sell property, to lend money at interest. That was all illegal in the Middle Ages. And it's wrong to think that all of a sudden, as a consequence of the bourgeois revolutions in the 17th and 18th century, the English Revolution, the French Revolution, it's wrong to think that all of a sudden then capitalism came into being when the monarchies were overthrown. That's not what happened. What happened was there was a sure but steady struggle by the nascent bourgeoisie to use all sorts of laws, whatever they could get their hands on, even church law. And finally, quantity turned into quality, and as Diderot said, they got big enough and they finally gave a push and the idol fell over. It took 800 years for capitalist law to come into place. And it took quite a while for the ruling elites in this country to come to the point where they've come now. I look at it going all the way back to 1846 with the war against Mexico when they seized that territory. And then they got through the First World War. They came out of the Second World War as top dog. Henry Luce, the editor of Time Life Media Complex, said, it's the American century. Well, that was 60 years ago. We'll see. But with their defeat of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the overthrow of non-capitalist property relations there to open up the Soviet Union again to their investments, with that, they then became the world unipower. It's because of that that they may be able to attack Iran, too. If significant changes in the law is the product of the struggle between social classes, what's happened to our class, the working class and its allies? Well, I think we've gone on the defensive and been steadily reduced in our power ever since the witch hunts of the 40s, when the radicals were kicked out of the great unions that were formed, when they were kicked out of public life. I mean, Pete Seeger couldn't even be on television. And with a momentary peak during the anti-war movement that we built and the radicalization of the 60s, it's been a steady defensive. Back and back they've pushed us. The percentage of people in unions is minuscule right now. The standard of living has gone way down. Fortune 500 published a list of the 400 richest people in the United States. Did you see that? Well, if you're a multimillionaire, you don't make the list. You don't even make the list if you're a billionaire. In order to the number 400 person on the bottom of that list was worth $1.3 billion. So when you're talking about consolidation of power, I mean, wealth isn't just only one example. There are people who are not that wealthy that are in the ruling elites. But nonetheless, you've got the upper 1% of this country owning the 90% of what's going on. You can't have a democracy with that kind of skewering. And you can't have a democracy, as Gibbon pointed out in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, you can't have imperialism abroad and democracy at home. And that's what's happened. Well, what to do? Organize, organize, organize. I interviewed Adam Hochschild, who wrote a book called Breaking the Chains. It's about the successful struggle in Britain to overthrow slavery. And that struggle started with 12 people in a tavern in 1784. 12 people. And this was the most horrendous and horrific and strong institution. And within 50 years, they were able to mobilize the population and overthrow it. So I think that we have to take the long view of history here. We got to start doing exactly what we're doing here, educating ourselves about what's happened, educating others, and starting to move against it. Thank you.
That was Michael Smith at a panel called Bricks in the Wall, How a U.S. Police State is Being Built, held at the Brecht Forum.
Vince Warren, the Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Thank you, Michael. Good evening, everyone. I've been the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights for just over a year. As Michael mentioned, I was on the board of the organization for about 6 years. In the last 6 years, since 9/11, and since the first detainees were brought to Guantanamo, the Center for Constitutional Rights, as you know, has been a real leader in pushing back, at least in the legal paradigm and in the paradigm of organizing and taking action to the streets, pushing back on some of the most egregious violations of human rights and constitutional rights that this administration has put forward. And I will agree with all of the speakers before me, and particularly with Clark, that and Michael, that there will be no concessions of power in the next administration. It just simply will not happen, and they will try to convince, and they will convince a fair portion of society that, oh, but we're only going to use this power for good and not for evil, like the last president did, and it simply won't happen, because the power that this administration has wrested from us, from the people, can only be used for repression, and only to solidify corporate interests both here and abroad. And do we have a president or do we have a king? Because this guy is acting like a king in all of the ways that Michael and Clark and Roberto have listed. And I don't give him great credit for thinking this up, but I do give him points for initiative and saying yes to the right people that are trying to take over the country, because that's what he's done. Seized on every opportunity and in very bold strokes to take over this country. And I think it's absolutely right, very much like Pearl Harbor, September 11th. We were all in a state of shock, and in a blink of an eye, 2 days later, after September 11th, the president had this military order. It really escaped the public consciousness for the most part. Then you had the Patriot Act, which I know for a fact that leading Congress people didn't even read before they signed on to it. Then you had the rounding up of South Asian and Muslim men around the country. I think it was close to 80,000. And a number of lawyers mobilized, at least to try to represent people, because the government wasn't even telling, the FBI wasn't even telling them that they had the right to a lawyer in these things. And this happened around the country. But, Guantanamo, the main issue is habeas corpus. And this represents a very fundamental constitutional attack on our rights as citizens. If you don't have the right to protest and to question why you're being thrown in jail on the executive say-so alone, you have no rights to speak of. And it is a very fundamental right, and the government is trying to parse a line that is, well, these are not American citizens. These are global jihadists in the war on terror that we picked up off the battlefield. And first of all, it's simply not true. And everybody knows this. The Center for Constitutional Rights, Gita Gutierrez, one of our lawyers, was the first lawyer to go down to Guantanamo. And she and the team have interviewed hundreds of men that are down there. It is quite clear that most of them were not pulled off the battlefield, and a lot of them were picked up from villages in places like Afghanistan for ransom, essentially, for people who were turned in for bounties is what it was. There's a famous quote of Donald Rumsfeld saying that we've been dropping leaflets in Afghanistan like snow falling in Chicago in December, and the leaflets were, you can have more money than you can ever imagine if you work with us to turn over the terrorists. And they were offering $3,000-$4,000, which is a tremendous amount of money, which families can live on for years. And there's one story of a man who I believe the center represented. He was at the Guantanamo for several years, and he returned to Afghanistan. And the man that turned him in to the military was living in his house. These are the worst of the worst. And literally people are being turned in, and they're taking over the families, they're taking over the crops, they're taking over the sheep herds. That's what's happening on the ground, very much like Pearl Harbor, and very much like every situation where the government perceives a threat and uses that threat as a mechanism to reach a broader goal. They round people up and essentially try to figure out the reason why they rounded people up through interrogation processes. I mean, people came to Guantanamo from a number of different places. These were not people that were picked up on the battlefield, Afghanistan, Iraq, different folks. They all ended up in a series of prisons in Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib. They also were held in these secret black sites that still exist and that we understand are still working, even though just about a year ago, the president, after having said that they don't exist and that we don't do that, said, well, we don't do it anymore if they did exist, but they still do it. Coming to Guantanamo, being dumped in this offshore penal colony, where the government takes the position that U.S. law doesn't apply, these folks, the president says, can be held indefinitely forever with no charges, no trial, no nothing, and no lawyer, no anything. Lawyering is, by essence, a very conservative method of advocating and moving for social justice. It's a necessary one. And as lawyers, it's interesting. We created what I consider a mass defense movement, essentially. So it's a mass legal services movement for the Guantanamo detainees. And The fact that we were able to get down and represent them, I think, is an interesting story in itself. But I think what's also very interesting about lawyering is that when you have lawyers present, very similar to when you have lawyers that go to the housing project and look at the conditions there, very similar to when you have lawyers that go to the Supermax prison and look at the conditions there, things start to change just because you have lawyers there. Once they bring people in, once they open it up for inspection, they have to come to account at least for some of the conditions there. And that's the same thing that happened in Guantanamo. We're going to be arguing that case. This is the third time that we're up in front of the Supreme Court. The first time, as you recall, was in 2004, the Rasul versus Bush case. The Rasul decision, the court said, hey, these guys have a right to go to federal court to challenge their detention. Congress then said, well, we'll fix that. We're going to pass the Detainee Treatment Act, which essentially strips them of their rights to go to federal court. The president said, we can do you one better. We're going to establish these military tribunals so they can't go to court, and we can establish the separate trial system for these guys to be tried by military tribunal. So we went to the Supreme Court again, and that was last year in the Hamdan case. In the Hamdan case, the Supreme Court said, and this is the Supreme Court, I mean, these aren't any of our friends by any means. These are folks that really probably had to pinch themselves in order to do the right thing for this, but they did do the right thing in some limited measure. They said two things. One, that the president exceeded his authority. Finally, somebody said it when he created these military tribunals because Congress didn't authorize it. And furthermore, the Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions apply to al-Qaeda. So you best be getting some lawyers in there and some people in there to talk to these folks because they have rights under international law that need to be adhered to. A month later, Congress said, well, we'll do you one better. We're going to pass the Military Commissions Act. So guess what? Now we've restricted the rights under the Geneva Conventions, and we've defined it so narrowly that nothing can be considered torturous under the Geneva Conventions. We're going to strip federal courts from hearing any of the habeas corpus cases. We're going to strip the detainees of any right to go to any court, any place in the world to talk about their cases. We're going to be able to say, the president can say that people walking down the street here in America are enemy combatants and he can throw them into jail. And this, I think, really ties into what Clark was saying. They gave blanket immunity to interrogators, to military officials, both here in the U.S. and abroad in Iraq and in Afghanistan. No one, not the Center for Constitutional Rights, not any of the detainees, can sue these guys for the torturous treatment that they've had. That all happened last year. So I think that, you know, if the pendulum does swing back, it's going to be a really short swing because we are now going back to the Supreme Court to try to undo what this last Congress has done by challenging the Military Commissions Act. But if you look at how this case has evolved, and this is over a 3.5-year period of time, and every day of those 3.5 years, there were at least 440 people that were stuck in Guantanamo virtually incommunicado. This is a conservative way to sort of focus it. The big joke is that, you know, the center has done some incredibly amazing lawyering in our 40 years. This is our 40th year. You know, we sued Crumpsey versus the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. We were one of the first organizations to get money damages from the Ku Klux Klan, and we filed Villarga versus Peña Irala under the Alien Tort Statute and was, you know, one of the first organizations to be able to sue foreign torturers in U.S. courts. And now, very much like Michael was saying, the country has moved so far to the right that habeas corpus litigation, for crying out loud, has become the radical lawyering of the day. And, you know, and anybody that's done habeas corpus will know, habeas corpus is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It is one of the hardest hurdles to pass if you have someone that's been convicted of a crime and that you're trying to get them released or trying to get a constitutional right heard. In essence, we've shifted our strategy or augmented our strategy where we really do work with movements, with social justice movements. And where does the movement want to take us? What kind of work has to be done? But the crisis here was so big that we decided to take it head on. We were the first organization out there, and we've been swinging ever since. I don't want to take up everybody's time, but I will mention just some of the other work that we're doing. Torture and Donald Rumsfeld. Nothing gives me greater pleasure. Nothing gives me greater pleasure than when we sued Donald Rumsfeld in yet another country. We've sued him now in two countries, and right after Congress passed the Military Commissions Act, and 6 days after he left office, we filed the lawsuit in Germany for war crimes against him, and not only Rumsfeld, but also David Addington and John Yoo and General Miller, who was the head of Abu Ghraib, for war crimes for their torture program and their torture policies. And, you know, to be clear, when people talk about torture, it is news to some people, it is not news to us, but what is really scary is that this is a program of torture. This is not a couple of people turning a blind eye in a particular facility or a couple of bad ass apples. This is a torture program that comes down from the top, and every moment of every day that we've been suing them, they've spent all of their time trying to block access to public documents, block access to their to those kind of policies. But it is really critical that we move forward on the torture program, the programmatic torture piece, because that is where the systematic repression comes in. We are also working on outsourcing torture, as Michael mentioned, with Meher Arar. And Meher Arar was the Canadian citizen that was flying through JFK, trying to get back to Canada. And they said, oh, no, we think you're Al-Qaeda, so we're going to send you to Syria. Syria? To be tortured? For 10 months he was tortured. Hadn't been in Syria since, I believe, he was a teenager. And, you know, what's shocking, when I think some of you were at this Second Circuit argument last month, the government got up and they said, oh, no, this, in front of the court, this is not extraordinary rendition. This was a routine immigration removal. Immigration? They said, well, of course, the lawyers up, this is why lawyers, you know, are a pain in the neck. The lawyer was up there and saying, well, judge, you know that when you fly into JFK, you're not really on U.S. soil, and so you're not admitted into the country, so we don't have to, so that the Constitution doesn't really apply to you there, and we can do whatever we want. And I think it was one of the judges who said, so you mean to tell me that somehow between the arrivals terminal and the Air Canada building, when he's riding on the bus to the Air Canada terminal, that you thought he was going to be in contact with so many Al-Qaeda operatives that you needed to send him to Syria to be tortured? I mean, that's the kind of madness and insanity that's going on underlying these cases. Warrantless wiretapping, the spying on Americans, is another lawsuit that we have. And this is a kind of an interesting take on the warrantless wiretapping case. There are a number of them, but ours is that it's CCR versus Bush, and we're suing with ourselves as the plaintiffs, individual lawyers as the plaintiffs, because we represent people in Guantanamo, Meher Arar, other folks that the government has declared, or at least has said that they think that they're terrorists, and therefore, under the NSA spying program, that we suspect that they are spying on us. And so we've filed a lawsuit, essentially, to get access to the spying that the government is doing on the Center for Constitutional Rights. We've also been able to move that type of government spying work into the Guantanamo situation, where we've pulled in about 500 law firms, and these are pretty mainstream conservative law firms that end up very often protecting corporate interests. And I don't want to overstate it by saying that we've radicalized them, but I will say that there were two things that happened that were interesting. One is that we got a number of these lawyers very interested in filing a FOIA request, a request under the Freedom of Information Act, and joining our lawsuit, essentially, because they think that they're being spied on, too, and it outrages them. I guess they're not really used to it. But, you know, but it's even moving the mainstream bar in that way. The other interesting story that I wanted to tell was, a while back, about a year ago, a government hack by the name of Cully Stimson, who had been deployed in media circles to try to raise to awaken capitalism in the face of trying to reclaim our rights. And he was going around on talk shows saying, well, I wonder what these big Fortune 500 companies would think if they found out that their lawyers were brought together by the Center for Constitutional Rights to represent these guys in Guantanamo. I was outraged. A number of us were outraged that that's the direction that they were going. But the lawyers, the corporate lawyers, were outraged. Outraged. And in fact, there was one person who was a managing partner of a very big law firm, and he sent an internal email to his office and said, I've talked it over with the partners, and if any client that we have has a problem with us representing the Guantanamo detainees, we'll fire the client. So in extraordinary times, there are these sort of extraordinary developments. But I think we, of course, need to be wise and keep focused on what the main issue is, which is trying to pull together whatever resources we can to push back the Bush administration down there. So I just wanted to drop that on you. Thank you all very much.
That was Vince Warren speaking at the Brecht Forum on Bricks in the Wall, How a U.S. Police State is Being Built.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Meet the king of cowboys. He rides a pale pony. He fights the bad boys. Brings them to their knees. He patrols the highways from the air. He keeps the country safe from long hair. I'm the masculine American man. I kill, therefore I am. I don't like the black man, for he does not know his place. Take the back of my hand, or I'll spray you with my mace. I'm as brave as any man.
Incarcerating 2.3 million people isn't cheap. Paul Wright unearths astonishing facts on the private prison industry and its needs to maintain occupancy rates in order to make a profit. The book Prison Profiteers tells you where your tax dollars are going as you help bankroll the biggest prison machine the world has ever seen. Prison Profiteers was also written by Tara Herriville, co-editor of Prison Nation. We welcome back Paul Wright to Law and Disorder. In addition to co-authoring Prison Profiteers, Paul is the founder and editor of Prison Legal News and a board member of the National Lawyers Guild. Paul, welcome again to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me on the show, Heidi.
Paul, we're really excited to talk about your new book, Prison Profiteers, that you and Tara Herriville have edited. And I've got to say, looking at the cover, when you first look at it, it looks like three men on a golf course. And then you realize that it's warden or supervisor watching two inmates. What I found really interesting about this book is, and what differentiates it from a lot of other books that talk about the cost of incarceration and the effect on inmates and their families, is that this talks about who benefits from it.
Basically, this is the, I guess to put this into perspective, this is the third prison legal news anthology that I've edited. Our first two was The Selling of America, an Inside Look at the U.S. Prison Industry. That came out in 1998 with Common Courage Press. The second book was Prison Nation, The Warehousing of America's Poor, which was published by Routledge in 2003. And those two books, I think, were kind of similar to a lot of what's published. We focused on, with those two books, who was harmed by America's mass imprisonment policies and kind of, you know, how did we get to that point? How did 2.3 million people wind up in prison? And then what's happening to them once they're in prison, which is generally not very good. We covered the racism, the rapes, the brutality, the beatings, the control units, everything else. But, you know, I think that every equation has two different parts to it. On the one hand, you've got who's harmed by policies. What generally people haven't been asking themselves is, well, who benefits from these policies? And I think that you don't have government policies where no one benefits, and I think that's the old Roman axiom of, you know, who benefits, when you want to ask, well, who's supporting this or who's pushing this?
Follow the dollar.
Yeah, or follow the dollar. I think that's the more recent variation of that. And one of the things that's always fascinating is periodically the Bureau of Justice Statistics issues reports on how much the criminal justice system is costing taxpayers. And typically, I think we're up to, I think the most recent one in 2004, 2005, said the U.S. is spending over $60 or $70 billion a year on its prisons and jails, and that actually understates the amount, because all that they're talking about is the operating expenses of prisons and jails, which is what government is spending to run the prisons it has. It doesn't count the capital construction costs of building the prison and jail system. What we start out doing with prison profiteers is looking at, well, who's profiting from this state of affairs? In other words, if $60 billion are being spent on this stuff every year, it's going into someone's pocket, because you know, the money isn't vanishing into thin air. It's not all-encompassing in that we're not tracking down literally every penny that's of those $60 billion, but we track down, you know, big chunks of it.
What components go into this?
You know, let's start off with the very front end of things, which is the building of prisons. Basically, since 1980 until the present in 2007, over that 27-year period, the United States has built over 1,000 new prisons. And I think the big thing there is, how are these prisons paid for? Typically, most states and the federal government and counties, they don't have the money on hand to pay for the prison construction. So what they do is they issue long-term bonds. And what these bonds do is they obligate the state or the county or federal taxpayers to paying for the construction of the facilities. And it's pretty fascinating, because this is one of the biggest transfers of taxpayer public wealth into private hands almost in American history. And between 1980 and the present, taxpayers have spent almost $1 trillion.
A trillion?
Well, I guess to put this into perspective, the United States spent around $600 billion for the savings and loan bailout in the 1980s. And by comparison, and with pretty much no fanfare, the United States has spent, and this is county government, state government, and the federal government, has spent between $800 and $900 billion in bonds to build prisons and jails.
That's just not building, but then what are the other big numbers that come in after you build them?
Well, the other big numbers that you come in with, and typically the reason no one thinks about the building costs is because these go into bonds that obligate taxpayers for years down the line.
Meaning we'll be paying taxes for many years.
Our grandkids are going to be paying for,
wow,
for these. That's part of the cost of building the prisons. And then the other one that comes up is then operating them. In other words, once you've built the prisons, you have to operate them, and that's millions more.
Some of those operating costs, does that include the electronic weapons that prison guards use?
Yes, that all goes towards the operating costs. And one of the chapters that we have in Prison Profiteers is a chapter on tasers. And Taser is a company based in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Yeah, we know about tasers. We've done programs on them. Mm-hmm. How much money is spent at the city, county, state, and federal level every year to run these prisons? And then my next question is going to be, how do you compare that to what's spent on education?
Well, it comes down to, overall, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the U.S. is spending between $60 and $70 billion a year to run its prisons and jails. And
Paul, you say $185 billion in this press release on this.
Right. That includes police, too.
When you bring in the cops,
how does
that compare to how much the governments spend on education for children?
Well, it's actually kind of a declining amount. And one of the things that there's been a number of studies done by different groups, which is interesting, because they show that as state governments spend more on prisons, they spend less on education.
The more on one, the less on the other, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And Basically, I think that one of the things that people need to understand is that, you know, typically, especially when you're talking about the state government and local government, is there's a finite amount of dollars available. And you've got a policy decision that has to be made is, okay, are we going to spend the money on building bridges, keeping the roads paved? Are we going to spend it on kindergarten and pre-K education for our kids? And are we going to spend it on schools and higher education for our kids? Or are we going to spend it on prisons and jail?
And it's like they have no relationship to each other, right? Like, the fact that you could spend more money for kids and probably have fewer people in jails doesn't really dawn on them, does it? That's why they wipe out education stuff even in prison.
Michael has an excellent point. Is, you know, there's also been plenty of studies that have shown that, you know, generally, the more education people have, the less likely they are to wind up in prison or jail. And, you know, there's real causal connections between pre-K programs, early childhood development programs and stuff like that, and criminal activity and behavior later on in life. So, Yeah, it's almost like if you're making the policy decision, if politicians are making the decision today to cut pre-K programs, education for kids, they're almost guaranteeing having to spend more money on prisons or jails later on down the lines. There is a real correlation between the two.
Let's cut to the chase. Who benefits from building more prisons and throwing billions and billions of dollars into this of our tax dollars every year?
Well, there's a lot of people that benefit from it. Starting out with the people that build the prisons and issue the bonds for it, you've got the investment banks and the bond brokerages, most of them based in New York City. Very familiar names. Lehman Brothers is very heavily invested. Private prison industry, for example, as far as making them a very big industry. They're pretty much, but all the bond brokerages, all the companies that issue bonds from municipal bonds and state bonds, they're all making a lot of money off of this because typically the way it happens is that they issue the bonds, investors buy the bonds, and regardless of what happens later on down the line, the investment brokerages and the bond brokers, they make a lot of money off of fees. The lawyers who write up the bond agreements, they also get their fees. So a lot of money is changing hands here up front.
Now, what about the American Correctional Association? They lobby on behalf of creating more...
Yes, basically the American Correctional Association, it's pretty much a taxpayer-funded lobby for prison officials.
How's it taxpayer-funded?
It's taxpayer-funded indirectly because pretty much they're a voluntary association. They're voluntary, but basically all the major prison officials around the country, they have 20,000 members, and typically... the prison officials aren't paying for their memberships out of their own pockets. They have their agencies pay for it. But the big racket that the ACA runs is the accreditation of facilities. They came up with this pretty much as a means to try to combat prison conditions litigation by prisoners. Their thing is, well, you know, if the ACA accredits a prisoner facility, then somehow judges who are being asked to rule on constitutional or unconstitutional conditions are supposed to give them a pass and say, well, they're accredited, so therefore the constitutional challenges, you know, shouldn't matter. And the courts, fortunately, have seen through this. But the racket that the ACA has, though, is that pretty much any detention facility that pays the ACA their thousands and tens of thousands of dollars in accreditation fees is pretty much assured of getting a certificate saying that they've been accredited by the ACA. And what does the accreditation mean in real life? Well, not a lot when you consider some of the most brutal and unconstitutional prisons in the country have been accredited by the ACA. And it's also a process that's shrouded in mystery. For example, the ACA won't tell you which, if any, facilities have ever failed an ACA inspection. They take the position that the accreditation reports themselves are confidential. And usually where people have been able to get them has been filing public records requests with the state agencies.
Paul, other segments that benefit from building all these prisons are the healthcare providers. And isn't most prisons now contract out to private healthcare providers?
There's a significant number. Two of the big players are Correctional Medical Services out of St. Louis, Missouri, and Prison Health Services, which is based in Tennessee. Between the two of them, and they're by far the biggest, and they have the most, as they put it, market share, they have operations in around 25 or 28 states, and those numbers vary at any given time. And all told, between them, probably 400,000 or 500,000 prisoners are under their medical care for those two companies. And basically, they've been able to step into a niche where... And I think the prison healthcare companies are almost, I call them the HMOs from hell, which...
You know, that's been my experience, too. I do injury litigation for a living, and every so often I'll get a letter from a prisoner describing to me the kind of healthcare that he or she gets or doesn't get.
Right.
It's an HMO from hell, and the HMOs aren't so good, but it's really unbelievable. They put people in there, and they don't do much for them, and they just collect money from us taxpayers to disregard these people's rights.
And I think that's the key thing to understand is that typically the contracts that these companies have with prisons and jails is they get a per diem amount where the agency pays them X amount of money depending on how many prisoners are in custody. The less health care they give, the more money they make.
Exactly.
And everyone would, I think the common sense thing would say, well, that's almost quite the sure recipe for inadequate health care, and it is, but that's kind of the state of affairs we have. Pretty much the horror stories and the problems are legion with these companies. Unfortunately, though, most of the states that have gone towards the privatization of their health care, they rarely go back to running it by the government. There's always problems with the vendors, and what we see is almost a revolving door where a state will contract with PHS 1 year, then after a few years of scandal and mismanagement, they'll contract with CMS, and then they go through that process again, and then they might go with a smaller vendor, and then they'll be back with PHS again. It's literally the revolving door of contractors. The problems remain the same.
There's a chapter on how prison labor supports the military. Can you briefly explain that?
Yes. Unicor is the trade name of Federal Prison Industries, and Federal Prison Industries was originally set up during the 1930s as a job training program for federal prisoners, also to give government agencies items at a lower cost than they'd otherwise get. It was supposed to be a win-win benefit. Prisoners get job training, earn a little bit of money, and when I say a little bit, we're talking, 14 cents to, I think their salary maxes out at $1.05 an hour. So little is the operative word. Government agencies are able to buy products at below market costs. So as things have evolved, it turns out that the Department of Defense is one of the biggest buyers of Unicor-made products. And federal prisoners make everything for the military, from uniforms to helmets to retrofitting Humvee Jeeps with blast armor to the cables for TOW missile launchers, cluster bomb casings, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And as the war in Iraq and Afghanistan have kind of ramped up, sales from Unicor to the Department of Defense have increasingly gone up, and we're talking $700, $800 million a year in sales of items made by federal prisoners to the Department of Defense.
Paul, that's really extraordinary, what you've just described. So they're exploiting prison labor at home to make arms for soldiers to exploit colonial people abroad. At the same time, they're cutting back on education so they can use money to build the prisons where they exploit the labor. So what you have really is a system that you could only call a decadent system. And it reminds me of an interview.
I think you're being too generous.
You got a better word. I'd like to hear it. We interviewed Marina Lazreg, who wrote a book called Torture in the Twilight of Empire. I think what you've been telling us about the whole prison industrial complex and who profits from it is just another chapter in the decline of empire.
I think that it gets even worse than that, because if you consider, for example, the fact that the federal prison system, 25% of the 200,000 people in the federal prison system aren't even U.S. citizens. And one of the things that's even more fascinating about Ian Urbina's article on Unicor and supplying the war machine is the fact that a lot of political prisoners are being forced to work in Unicor. And this includes some of the defendants who were convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, like Mohamed Salameh and some of his co-defendants. These are prisoners, they're political prisoners, regardless what your view is on the merits or demerits of the convictions or whatever, but obviously they were convicted of political offenses, and they're being forced to work in Unicor. And this isn't just those. Oscar Lopez Rivera, a longstanding fighter for the independence of Puerto Rico, he's been in federal prisons for several decades. Ray Lavasser, who's since been released, another former political prisoner. These are all people that have been forced to work in Unicor's war production.
Yeah, it really spins your head. Prison profiteers, who makes money from mass incarceration?
People can order it from Prison Legal News, and our website is www.prisonlegalnews.org.
And Paul, this will be available in bookstores in January?
Yes, it'll be available in all bookstores and Amazon.com and the other online retailers after January 1st. And if your bookseller or bookstore doesn't have it, I hope people get after them to order it for them. In the meantime, they can also order it directly from Prison Legal News.
Paul Wright, author of Prison Profiteers, Who Makes Money from Mass Incarceration. Been very good talking to you. Good luck with your book.
Congratulations, okay. Paul. Thanks.
Okay. And thanks for having me on the show.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains. Who denies of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, while it's freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new nation. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Sat lie about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. From the strength that resides within. Go toe to toe with the panther and you just can't win. Self-proclaim best, suppress the rest. The rich get richer and the poor take less. The American dream was an American nightmare. You kept my people down and refused to fight fair. The Ku Klux Klan tried to keep us out with signs proof and state no blacks allowed. With intimidation and segregation was the way for our freedom, but now we're impatient. Blacks, the other of skin, yeah, don't sell out. Freedom, equality, get out, yell out. Don't you never be ashamed of what you are. It's your panther power that makes you a star. Panther power. Panther power. My mother never let me forget my history, hoping I was set free. Chains that were put on me, wanted to be more than just free. Had to know the true facts about my history. I couldn't settle for being a statistic. Couldn't survive in this capitalistic government, cause it was meant to hold us back. Using ignorance, drugs, the sneak attack in my community. They killed the unity, but when I charge them, trying to claim immunity. I strike America like a case of heart disease. Panther power is running through my arteries. Try to stop me, oh boy, you'll be clawed to death, cause I'll be fighting for my freedom with my dying breath. Do you remember? That's what I'm asking you. You think you're living free? Don't make me laugh at you. Open your eyes, realize you've been locked in chains. Said you wasn't civilized and stole your name, cause some time has passed. See, to all forget, there is no liberty for you and me. We ain't free yet. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. As it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains. Who denies of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, while it's freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new nation. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Sat lie about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power.
From the rebel to you.